So I was planning to continue from where I left off yesterday. As you may remember, I concluded with this verse from the Bhagavad Gita. So I'd like to continue here. I thought maybe we could recite in Sanskrit together. It's, you know, recite in Sanskrit, like, this is very purifying and makes us sober. You know, Prabhupada, he introduced chanting of or recitation of Sanskrit before lectures, when devotees were getting absorbed, and especially book distribution, and they were getting so intoxicated that they had a hard time controlling themselves. They were actually getting intoxicated and sometimes a little silly and foolish by, you know, so much ecstasy and book distribution. So then he introduced, before lectures, we chant Sanskrit just to calm the mind and become serious and sober. Isn't that true? You heard that? No, yeah, that's when he introduced it. Ishvara Sarvabhutanam. Ishvara Sarvabhutanam. Pritisiyatyunatishtati. Pritisiyatyunatishtati. Brahmayan Sarvabhutani. Brahmayan Sarvabhutani. Yantra Rudani Mayaya. Yantra Rudani Mayaya. Please chant. So, the Supreme Lord is situated in everyone's heart, O Arjuna, and is directing the wanderings of all living entities who are seated as on a machine made of the material energy. So, as I concluded yesterday, I propose this verse is actually our understanding of nature, what nature actually consists of. This verse states that there are not only one thing in nature, namely matter, but actually there is matter, and then there is consciousness, and consciousness can again be divided into two categories, the individual consciousness and the super consciousness, so super soul pervading everything. Or actually, mind, matter, the matter, mind, and consciousness might even be more precise, because mind is, of course, mind is also matter, but not matter as modern scientists conceive of matter. It's a much more subtle state of matter. And then there is consciousness, which again can be divided into two categories. So I'm going to look a little at that and give some scientific evidence that indicates actually that, you know, nature or reality has to be understood in terms of matter, mind, and consciousness. So this is a physicist called Dean Radin from Princeton University, who in from 89, he was published in 89, he made, what is it called, a mega study of experiments with random number generators. Mega study is a study of studies. There had been performed many, many experiments with these random number generators. And Radin, he collected all the results from all these studies and put them together and, got some results from that. So, what was the experiments on these random number generators? A random number generator is, a electronic device that randomly puts out ones and zeros. And naturally, when, you know, if you have enough numbers coming out, then the distribution should be 50-50, half of each. But test subjects, they were asked, try to see if you can influence the outcome of these random number generators with your mind by thinking. You know, thinking. Can you affect it? Of course, you say that's not possible. But anyway, there actually have been made a lot of experiments like that all over the world. From it says from 1959 to 1987, and Radin, he discovered that this distribution of 51 to 49% instead of 50 to 50%. Now that doesn't might sound to be very much, but the number of tests were so large that actually the probability for this being random chance was less than 10 to the minus 12, one in a trillion. This is statistically significant. This is not chance. In other words, there seems to be mind or consciousness can affect matter in some ways. So this is kind of the first topic, that mind is some kind of matter, and subtle matter can actually influence gross matter. Actually, it turns out there are many scientists who have been investigating that topic, both in modern times, and it's still going on, and also if you go back, even back to the 1800s, many scientists, they were investigating into that. I'll give you a few examples. Quote from before going to the next, but this is Dean Radin again. There are disagreements over how to interpret the evidence, but the fact is that virtually all scientists who have studied the evidence, including the hard-nosed skeptics, now agree that something interesting is going on that merits serious scientific attention. But here is the next example here of, it's a discussion about dogs. Do dogs have a sixth sense? And we have all had experience of dogs. Have you? You tried to have a dog, isn't it? Maybe not as high Christian devotees, but we familiar with dogs. And have you had the experience that of course dogs get very attached to their masters and to those they live with, that when the dogs when you're coming home, returning home from work, returning home from school like that, and the dog is there and he is all over, he's jumping up and down and running forth and back, and he's so happy to see you. This is why we get dogs, because there's someone who loves you unconditionally. So that is nice. I remember when I used to come home from school, then our dog, he would come out and outside and run to a certain point. You couldn't go further. He was not allowed to go further beyond that. But then he would be out there and he would be wagging his tail like anything. And I was happy to see him also. This is Rupert Sheldrake. He's a British biologist. He actually wanted to research the question. Dogs, do they know when their masters are coming home? Because it seems that they're always there when the master is on the home. Suddenly, then the dog gets all excited like that. Does a dog know that or like that? So actually he got in touch with this woman here, Pamela Smart, from Manchester in England, who had a dog named Jaiti. And Sheldrake, he advertised for some test subjects, and then she thought, actually that's interesting, because it looks like this Jaiti, he has like a sixth sense. Whenever I'm coming home, he's always at the door. And she used to have a work, regular work. She would come home at the same time every day. So she thought, and her parents, she was living with her parents at that time. They were also around the time when she was come home, the dog would go to the door. So they thought that the dog knows this is the time she's coming home. So therefore, the dog is always there. But then she was laid off. She lost a job. So, and from then on, she didn't come home at regular times. She would go out, and they didn't know when she would come back. But still, when she came back, you know, before she came back, the dog was by the door. So she thought maybe that would be interesting to, you know, work with Rupert Sheldrake on this, you know, experiment. And then she would also have a job, you know. And so they, from 1994 to 1996, they made 200 experiments where they very simply put up a video camera in front of the door. And then when Pamela, she left home, she would just turn on the video camera, and the video camera would just be running all the time. And when she came back, she would turn it off. And then the recording would be sent to Rupert Sheldrake for, you know, for filing. And then in the end, let's see here, how is that? Yeah. This was published in a paper that Rupert Sheldrake and Pamela Smart wrote. A dog that seems to know when his owner is coming home, videotaped experiments and observations. Because they discovered that Jaiti, he would go to the door, I mean, if nothing was happening, 5 to 10% of the time he would be by the door. Sometimes a cat was passing, then he would be there barking. Or sometimes the sun was shining through the window in the door, then he would be snoozing in front of it. But 5 to 10% of the time he would spend in front of the door when nothing was happening. But when Pamela was on her way home, I mean, she would be, of course, write down, now I'm going home, she would write the time. Then it turned out that the dog would be there 50 to 60% of the time. And they made many experiments where she would leave and come home very shortly after, and sometimes she would be gone for many, many hours and almost a whole day. And she would go just to the neighborhood. Sometimes she would be, you know, 50 or 100 kilometers away. And often she would decide herself when she would go home, but sometimes it would be, the agreement was that she wouldn't return home until Rupert Sheldrake beeped her, now we start going home. So they made, made different, many different conditions so to see actually if, you know, what, you know, if there's any pattern the dog was following. And they couldn't see it, there was nothing, there was no pattern. And there was no way that the dog could hear it as she is coming home, because also sometimes she was driving her car, but sometimes you would take a bus or train. And anyway, I mean, it's in Manchester, it's a heavy congested city, there's so much noise. I mean, the dog cannot distinguish the sound of a car, especially if she's quite far away. So they concluded that, this dog seems to have a telepathic sense, you know, and he's, Rupert Sheldrake has made other experiments like that, actually, that, you know, indicate animals have this telepathic sense, and humans also do have it. He made experiments where, can you feel when someone is staring at you from behind? Or when the phone is ringing, can you guess who is ringing? He made experiments, and it turns out, there seems to be, you know, people that we can sense it. We can sense these things to some degree, not always 100%, but there's something there. And so these kind of phenomena, they have been investigated for centuries, actually. And many famous scientists have been involved in this paranormal research. And I could mention a whole lot. Actually, you can go and read. How many have read Tutankhamun's book, Human Devolution? You have read? Something. You've read, yeah. So there he gives so many examples. I've taken mainly the examples. At least some examples I've taken here, they're from his book. But he mentioned so many top scientists were involved in that. One example is Marie and Pierre Curie. They were I mean, some of the most famous scientists of all time, they were discoverers of radioactivity and the element radium. And they got, you know, they got Nobel Prize. Even Marie Curie got Nobel Prize twice. And so they're known as some of the greatest physicists of all time. What many do not know is that they are also into psychic research and spiritism. And they were in the University of Paris. They were experimenting with media, spiritistic media, who were able to speak, you know, strange languages and cause objects to move without touching them and stuff like that. So and the reports are supposed to be they're still at this psychological laboratory in the University of Paris. This is from Pierre Curie. There is, according to me, a completely new domain of facts and physical states of space of which we presently have no idea. Pierre Curie wrote in a letter on July 24, 1905, "We had at the Psychological Society a few seances with the medium Eusapio Palladino. It was very interesting, and truly those phenomena that we have witnessed seemed to us not to be some magical tricks. A table lifted 4 feet above the floor, movements of objects, feelings of hands that pinched you or caressed you, apparitions of light. All of this in a room arranged by us with a small number of spectators, all well known and without the presence of a possible accomplice. Cheating would only be possible if the medium had extraordinary abilities as a magician. But how to explain the different phenomena when we are holding her hands and legs and the lighting of the room is sufficient to see everything going on?" So again, he said, "There is, according to me, a completely new domain of facts and physical states of space of which we presently have no idea." So, very interesting. Why has that not been, you know, they discovered radioactivity, why wasn't it, you know, became as similar well known that also they were also discovering, you know, spiritism, spiritistic phenomena? I don't know. Maybe it's not within the materialistic paradigm. Maybe that's why it's not being known. But as I say, there are many scientists who were into spiritism. This is not one of them. This is Charles Darwin. But this is one of them. As you may know, that theory of evolution is associated with Charles Darwin, but actually there were two together in formulating the theory of evolution, Charles Darwin and Alfred Russel Wallace. And because actually Darwin was working on his theory of evolution for many years. Alfred Russel Wallace was a young scientist and researcher who came upon the same idea. And he actually wrote a letter to Darwin and presenting him his theory of evolution. And Darwin, he said to be shocked, because he had this young man and it was his same theory. And Darwin had been working on it for many years. He considered it his theory. But now this young man was to get the credits. So Darwin was a little panicked. So then he consulted with Charles Lyell, a good friend of his. And Charles Lyell suggested to Darwin, "Why don't you propose to Wallace that you publish the theory together?" And so Darwin did, and Wallace said, "Yes, good idea," because he was a young man. Darwin was already famous. So Wallace thought it'll be, you know, nice to be known as being associated with a famous man. So they published the theory together. But then afterwards, now we only know Darwin, because then later he published his book and that became famous. But the theory was published the year before by both of them. And Wallace, somehow or other, is not so known anymore. And, in his time he was still famous, but not, say, on the same level as Darwin. And maybe one reason is that actually he drifted off into research into the paranormal and spiritism. And Darwin did not like that. here that Darwin wrote in a letter to Wallace, "I hope you are aware that you are murdering our common child. You're undermining the theory of evolution, because the theory of evolution, at least according to Darwin, is a materialistic theory, and everything can be explained in terms of physics and chemistry. But Wallace, he was showing there's actually more to life than that." So, here there's a quote from Wallace. "I ought to state that for 25 years I had been an utter skeptic as to the existence of any preterhuman or superhuman intelligences, and that I never for a moment contemplated the possibility that the marvels related by spiritualists could be literally true." So that was his starting position. He was a skeptic, but he was a scientist, and he came across that spiritualists, they're making some fantastic claims. So he started researching it. Together with another scientist, William Crookes, I think it was. I don't remember exactly. And quite a famous physicist all together. And together they were investigating spiritistic media. And they investigated, for example, one named Daniel Douglas Humes. He was Scottish and a young man, but he had some amazing abilities. He could, he could in broad daylight create all kinds of phenomena. He could get musical instruments to play without anyone touching them. Objects lifting off the ground and so on. And so they were experimenting with him, and they described that the way they would do it, they would come unannounced to this Hume's door. Of course, they had agreement. We'll come at one point, but we'll not tell you when we'll come. And then they'll come and say, "Okay, now we go." And then they would bring him to a place that he had never been before, so he couldn't have arranged anything there. So then, in the presence of a number of scientists, then this Daniel Hume, he would perform, you know, all kinds of far out phenomena, including even one, you know, person's lifting off the ground, floating out an open window, floating out, floating in another window, coming down again. I mean, what do we know? But we have these scientists. They have reported that that's what they saw. And that was what Wallace was doing. You can read it. He published a book called "The Scientific Aspect of the Supernatural," and that you can go on Google Books. You can find it on Google Books. There he talks about all the experiments that he was observing, and he became a very spiritual person. He says. This is 1896, he wrote, "If I've now changed my opinion, it is simply by the force of evidence. It is from no dread of annihilation that I've gone into this subject. It is from no inordinate longing for eternal existence that I've come to believe in facts which render this highly probable if they do not actually prove it." Let's just see what... And he says, the world and the whole material universe exist for the purpose of developing spiritual beings. Death is simply a transition from material existence to the first grade of spirit life." He believed in reincarnation, and he thought that he still believed in evolution, but he thought that the material evolution we observe is simply there reflecting or facilitating a deeper spiritual evolution for spiritual beings evolving, and bodies are being evolved to facilitate the spiritual development. So I don't know if that's true, but it's better than Darwin for sure. Light years better than Darwin. Wallace was a very sensible person. If he had lived today, I would like to meet him, and I think he would like what we are doing. And the funny thing is, I mean, that they started out the same, and actually they went through many things. He was also, you know, a religious person, Wallace, and it said that Darwin, he lost his faith in God, or whatever, if he had any to begin with, when one of his daughters died, and kind of thought that, you know, how can God do this? God cannot exist. Wallace also lost a daughter, and like that, but he didn't, you know, he didn't, actually he became more spiritual because of that. So, let's see here. Consciousness. We get to the point of consciousness. What is consciousness? I mean, the strict materialist, of course, will say it's just some activity going on in the brain, some processes in the brain, some neurons interacting and so on. But then again, you will also find very materialistic persons in admitting it is actually a very mystical thing, very unexplainable thing. This is Thomas Huxley. He was called Darwin's bulldog, and he was the one who really went around and debated evolution with everyone, with scientists and non-scientists and priests and theologians and like that. Darwin did not do that. He published his book and he wrote an awful lot of letters, but he was not such an outgoing, confrontational person like that, but Huxley he was. So actually it's just as much due to Huxley that theory of evolution became established. And he was actually, I mean, it was a very, you know, very goal-oriented process to establish the theory of evolution in the scientific world. Huxley is also the founder of the journal Nature, which he founded with the express purpose of promoting evolution, like that. So that's why you will not find any anti-evolutionary science in Nature, because the purpose of Nature is to promote evolution. But anyway, he admitted that consciousness is very difficult to explain. I understand the main tenet of materialism to be that there is nothing in the universe but matter and force, and that all the phenomena of nature are explicable by deduction from the properties assignable to these two primitive factors. It seems to me pretty plain that there is a third thing in the universe, to wit, or that means namely, consciousness, which I cannot see to be matter or force or any conceivable modification of either. So he admits it's actually, it doesn't seem to be material. Of course, if you read then he continues explaining why it's probably matter anyway. But he admits it's very difficult to explain, but as matter, doesn't seem to be matter or force or energy or anything like that. Other scientists also have said, like this is Eugene Wigner, quantum physicist, Nobel laureate, and also quite a spiritual person actually. He once wrote in 1964 that two kinds of reality or existence, the existence of my consciousness and the reality or existence of everything else. The latter reality is not absolute, but only relative. That's a very good observation. And it's actually interesting. Modern science started more or less with the observation that consciousness is real. I don't know if you know that, but if you go back to around the end of the 1500s, there's a French philosopher, Descartes, René Descartes, and he's considered the one who initiated the whole modern science adventure. And he started the scientific approach by being skeptical. Before that, to be a learned person meant you accepted what came down by tradition, especially Aristotle's, you know, the physics and the metaphysics of Aristotle's. But Descartes said, no, I would like to find out what can we know for certain. What can we know for certain? And in order to do that, he entered on a process of doubting, because he wanted to see, you know, can we reach a point or can we get to something which cannot be doubted? So that's in a kind of modern scientific thinking. You doubt, so it reads down to what you can say for certain. And Descartes, he concluded that, well, many things can be doubted. Actually, practically everything can be doubted. Of course, what we have learned, what we've heard, who knows if that is true. Even our senses, you know, how do we know if our senses are giving us correct information and so on. So then you come down to the point, I can doubt everything, except there's one thing I cannot doubt, and that is that I'm doubting. I cannot doubt that I'm doubting. And therefore, I must exist. So I can be, yeah. And therefore, you probably know this cogito ergo sum. You heard that Latin?
I think that's
yeah, that's how it's translated. But it's actually, the correct translation is actually, I doubt, therefore I am. I doubt, therefore I am. So that so he reached that conclusion, that I must exist. You know, that's real. And from there, that the self is real, then he extrapolated, actually concluded, therefore God must also exist. And like that. But so modern science started with the realization the self exists. And you talk about Cartesian duality, mind, which here means consciousness, and matter. But some another, they lost track after Descartes, after the time of Descartes, and got absorbed only in matter and forgot to look into what is the self. Yeah, but I mean, okay, here's another quote from about another scientist who is also accept that consciousness is something else. Brian Josephson, do you know Brian Josephson?
Not personally.
Not personally, but you know him by name. Yeah. He's a famous physicist. He's Nobel laureate, quantum physicist. He writes here, science needs to try to understand the observer and to respond vigorously to the challenge of consciousness research. Physics may have moved too fast forward toward a tempting conclusion, in brackets, that the laws of quantum physics are the ultimate description of reality, and thrown out the crucial and subtle intelligence of the observer as a part of this process. And also I have example here. European philosophy, has this, point that actually consciousness is something that is different from the body. Here is a quote from Phaedo, which is it's one of Plato's books, which has recorded the last dialogue of Socrates, the day when Socrates he was executed. This is what Phaedo is about. And it's interesting that on that day, his friends, they came to the prison where Socrates was imprisoned. And they came fairly early and knocked on the door and, asked the prison guard, can we see Socrates today, because today is his last day. And then the jail guard said, you're too early, he's still sleeping. Which is, of course, a little amazing. He knows he's going to be executed, but he's still sleeping. So, but then finally he wakes up, and he meets his friends, and he's in good spirits because, of course, he had a good night's sleep. So, of course, you'll feel good. There's no. For his friends, they're all upset. We have a plan. We can get you out of here, and we can bring you to another country. We can give you a new existence and new life, and like that. So I said, no, that's not. It's not morally right, This is. I've always, been following moral principles and, obeying Athens. That's it. When Athens was, favoring me and benefiting me, then I would take advantage of Athens. Now Athens wants to execute me, so I should alter. I would be a hypocrite if I suddenly would not accept the authority of Athens at this moment. But then say, but you're going to die. They'll kill you. And then someone say, no, I'm not dying. I'm not dying. And then they have a discussion. Is there life after death or not? And then Socrates, He gives some good arguments. He talks about the body and the self, and he says, here's a conclusion. You know, you can see very well, this is Socrates. Then, in the light of all that we have said both now and before, to which class do you think that the soul bears the closer resemblance and relation? You can also, the self is probably more precise translation. And Sabus says, I think, Socrates, that even the dullest person would agree from this line of reasoning that the soul is in every way possible more like the invariable than the variable. Socrates, and the body to the other. I know, can you recognize the argument? This is Dehinos Minyatade He. Plato has the same, Socrates has the same argument as in Bhagavad Gita, that the body is changing, but the self is constantly the same. And Socrates uses this as the argument why there's no death. And that's why he's completely fearless. Prabhupada called him a self-realized, a Brahman-realized person. We see here, he was a self-realized person, and he was not disturbed by dying. So it's in one sense, and that might be the best scientific argument, actually, for the self being different from the body, because the self has a complete different nature. It's a constant, consciousness is constantly there, and everything else is changing. If you want some more concrete evidence for the self actually being, different from the body, well, there are scientists also who are making, some very, you might say, more concrete experiments. I mean, if you can say it like that. But there are scientists who are studying near-death phenomena and also reincarnation research. So let's have a look at these now. First, the near-death or out-of-body experiences, because it appears that there are many instances, reports of people in a state of coma or clinical death. Who go into a state of clinical death, but they are revived. And when they come back, they actually report being conscious, but outside of the body. It's not an unknown phenomenon. Many do not know it, but it's quite a well-known phenomenon. I'm going to show one example just for sake of rising.
Whilst near-death experiences change lives, they've also given some individuals extraordinary experiences that they would never have dreamt of. The most intriguing examples are of blind people becoming sighted for the first time. Viki Naratak had been blind from birth.
I've never seen anything, no light, no shadows, no nothing. A lot of people ask if I see black. No, I do not see black. I do not see anything at all. And in my dreams, I don't see any visual impressions. It's just taste, touch, sound, and smell, but no visual impressions of anything.
In her early 20s, Viki was involved in a serious car accident.
The next thing I recall, I was in Harborview Medical Center and looking down at everything that was happening. And it was frightening because I'm not accustomed to see things visually because I never had it before. And initially it was pretty scary. And then I finally recognized my wedding ring and my hair. And I thought, is this my body down there? And am I dead or what?
You can't bring her back, it's impossible.
They kept saying, we can't bring her back, we can't bring her back. And they were trying to frantically work on this thing that I discovered was my body, and I felt very detached from it. And sort of, so what? And I was thinking, what are these people getting so upset about? Then I thought, I'm out of here. I can't get these people to listen to me. And as soon as I clocked out, I went up through the ceiling as if it were nothing. And it was wonderful to be out there and be free, not worry about bumping into anything. And I knew where I was going. And I heard the sound of wind chimes. It was the most incredible sound that I could describe. It was from the very lowest to the very highest tones. As I was approaching this area, there were trees and there were birds and quite a few people, but they were all like made out of light. And I could see, and it was incredible, really beautiful. And I was overwhelmed by that experience because I couldn't really imagine what light was like. It's still a very emotional thing when I talk about this because there was a point at which I could bring forth any knowledge I wanted to have. And it was like this place was where all knowledge was. And then I was sent back, and then I went back into my body, and it was excruciatingly painful.
Have you seen this before? How many have seen this before? There are many reports like that. I mean, also many films about it and so on. And even serious scientists have been discussing this and researching that. And even in 2002, a big article appeared in The Lancet. The Lancet is the world's leading medical journal. It's century old journal. English comes every month. Only the best scientific research is published in The Lancet. So there, this Dutch cardiologist, he had an article called "Near Death Experience in Survivors of Cardiac Arrest: A Prospective Study in the Netherlands." And he described how he had been interviewing heart attack survivors. It says here, all of whom were interviewed within a week of resuscitation from clinical death. 62% or 18% reported memories during the period when they were clinically dead. 70% had very deep near-death experiences. So, and he goes on describing some of these cases. He described one instance. One man had been, rushed to the hospital due to a heart attack and being complete coma. And he had been revived, and now he was lying in the hospital recuperating. But what happened was, the thing was that he had been revived, was still living, but he lost his teeth. Somehow or other, the doctors, they had taken his teeth out of his mouth, and nobody knew what happened to the teeth. So he was lying there, and then suddenly he sees a nurse passing by, and then he shouts, "Hey, nurse, come here! You know where my teeth are. You took them out of my mouth when I was unconscious, and you put them in the drawer in this crash cart, and they must be there." So then they went and looked, and actually they found the teeth. So he tells stories like that. People, they seem to have experiences, and conscious experiences, which should not be possible if consciousness was something that went on in the brain. Which apparently only can be explained by the fact that they seem to be able to leave the body and be fully conscious outside the body. So it's actually quite well documented, and many medical doctors have looked into it. Here's one example. Michael Sabum is another. He's an American cardiologist who also research this, and we're interviewing patients and actually concluding, yes, there's something real going on here. And he writes here, having been on both sides of this argument, I now believe that the near-death experience is not simply the result of misfires within the dying brain, but that it is a spiritual encounter. Thousands of documented testimonies speak to the near-death experience as being a spiritual experience, perceived to be both real and otherworldly. Yeah, like that. Then here, this is, of course, this is Ian Stevenson. We all familiar with Ian Stevenson, I think all too. Yes? You're not? Who's not? Okay. You should be. Stevenson is, he's quite monumental. Ian Stevenson was a Canadian psychiatrist who for 45 years was investigating into children remembering past lifetimes. He started in the early 60s, and he actually went to India to start with, India and Sri Lanka, where he studied a few cases and got some, found some positive cases where he was able to, not only document that a child was speaking about some, apparently about a previous lifetime, but he was actually able to track down the person that the child had been before to, confirm actually such a person did exist. And the child apparently had no way of knowing about this in a natural way. In the 1960s, he wrote a book called 20 Cases Suggestive of Reincarnation, where he goes through some cases from all over the world. And he worked on it his whole life, for more than 45 years. And finally documented something like at least 2,500 cases where he could confirm there was a person that conformed to a child's, child's memories. It's a very big body of reincarnation research, the biggest body ever made. He had a professorship at a university in Virginia in America. He was sponsored by Carlson, the one who invented the Xerox copy machine. He had a very wealthy sponsor. That's why he could go on with his research and have a whole department working on that. And actually, they're still going on. I'm going to show you that here in the end. The work is still. He has some successors who are working on that still. And but 2,500 or 3,000 documented instances of a deceased personality corresponding to a small child's remembrance of a previous lifetime. I mean, this is a very big body of evidence. And Stevenson concluded kind of one in every 500 children seems to have memories from a past lifetime. So it's not a big percentage, it is definitely, there is something there. And of course, the memories are often, they are very prominent there when they're from 2 to 4 or 5 years old, and most of them, then they fade out, they start forgetting them, and so on. But on top of the 3,000 documented instances, he also documented 700 instances of children having not only memories but also birthmarks and or birth defects that apparently corresponded to something that happened in the previous lifetime of the previous personality, which is very concrete. That is something that you can actually see with your eyes. For example, here is a young Indian man. His name is Hanuman Sasena. At this time, he's 16 years old, and he remembered or claimed to remember a previous lifetime, where he was. He remembered having been a farmer in the same village where he grew up. And one evening, he was coming home from the field, and he was in the doorway of his house, looking out on the street. And someone passes on the street and suddenly points a shotgun towards him and fires a shotgun at him, and you know, hits him in the chest and kills him. So he remembered that. And he was born with some spots on his chest, you know, light spots on his chest. And when Stevenson, he researched that case, he found that these marks, they corresponded exactly to the wounds from the shotgun on the farmers, this Maharam Singh's, from his post-mortem, from his, you know, from the medical doctors, from their report from this farmer's death. So he has 700 cases like that. So it's very hard to explain it as anything else but reincarnation. That actually the self can seemingly survive and go from body to body. And as I said, research is still going on. Even have one of the brahmacharis in Copenhagen, he just corresponded with this institute and the leader, his name is Jim Tucker, and about their work, and said yes, they're still researching and so on, and still digging up cases. Very big body of evidence for reincarnation. So anyway, I mean, you might say it's not mainstream science is ignoring this kind of evidence, but science actually shows that the self is different from the body. Now I'll go on to have a look at some evidence for the super soul. You know, can we perceive the, you know, not only the conscious self, but can we also perceive the super soul? And you know, and it might be that in that two phenomena at least that appears to be very hard to explain, except from the by introducing that there is a higher consciousness that is the source of these two phenomena, and they are inspiration and instincts. Inspiration and instincts, and I guess we are familiar with both. Sometimes we're inspired, sometimes of course we're also very uninspired, which is actually very telling, because that means it's not under our own control. Sometimes we have the experience of you know we can write or speak fantastically beautiful, brilliantly, or make fantastic music, or art, or just be very quick with jokes or something like that. I mean, sometimes do you tell jokes sometimes? Is that popular in Slovenia to tell jokes? the best jokes, they just pops up like that, and they're just quick remarks. You know, you hadn't planned them or anything like that, but they're just so right on. You know, Prabhupada was very inspired with jokes also. You know, had this, you know, like for example, this female reporter, who asked Prabhupada, why do you have bald heads? And she was in a miniskirt with bare legs, and Prabhupada immediately said, why do you have bare legs? So I don't think Prabhupada prepared that; it just came out like that. That's inspiration. And then she was completely flustered, and then Prabhupada said, better to have a cool head than cold legs. You need a, you know, something like that. So it's an inspiration is actually an interesting phenomenon. And some very inspired people understand this is actually not coming from me. Mozart, for example, he was a naturally an extremely inspired person. And his music was pure inspiration. It wasn't hard work. Mozart tells here, when I feel well and in good humor, or when I'm taking a drive or walk, thoughts crowd into my mind as easily as you could wish. Whence and how do they come? I do not know and have nothing to do with it. Once I have a theme, another melody comes, linking itself with the first one, in accordance with the needs of the composition, as a whole. It does not come to me successively with its various parts worked out in detail, as it will be later on, but it is in its entirety that my imagination lets me hear it. And he accredits this to God, actually. You know, inspiration must be coming from God. So Mozart was not sitting down with a paper and notes and trying, does this note fit with this one, and then, you know, work note by note by note. No, they just came like that. Another example is a mathematician called Carl Gauss, very famous mathematician, and he was working on a mathematical problem for several months, and he couldn't get anywhere with it, he describes. So finally he just gave up and he got tired. And maybe said, I'm not going to be a mathematician anymore. So then he went on a field trip with some geologists, and he was out, you know, and, you know, just, you know, something else and doing something else. And then he explains that suddenly, when he was just about step up on a cart, bing, the whole solution to a mathematical problem was there in his mind. He writes, finally 2 days ago I succeeded. Like a sudden flash of lightning, the riddle happened to be solved. I myself cannot say what was the conducting thread which connected what I previously knew with what made my success possible. But again, I mean, he was, you know, he understood something divine is going on. You know, I'm getting inspiration like that. So inspiration is an interesting phenomenon. And I mean, it's also, we can, if we are Krishna conscious, actually, we should become more inspired. And I think devotees, that's why devotees also are poetic, for example. You know, they are inspired by Krishna. So, instincts in animals seems to be a somewhat similar phenomenon. Animals have incredible behaviors and act in ways that often make us wonder, how do they know how to do that? You know, where do they, you know, how can they, I mean, because animals are not intelligent. I mean, of course they have some intelligence, but not, I mean, not very, you know, advanced intelligence as such. Which one knows when one deals with animals, I mean, you know, they're people, they've, you know, when we love them and so on, but they're not very intelligent as such. But then again, they have very intelligent behavior. So there are so many examples of this. The Hungarian devotee and scientist Isvara Krishna has discussed this in his book Nature's IQ. And you can read that. He gives so many excellent examples. And also here, there's a video. I just copied from Radha Govinda Babu the Nature's IQ film. I saw you had that. I was looking for that. So I'm going to see it now. So there's some of these examples that Isvara Krishna has given. Is, for example, of the salmon, which is a very interesting fish. Salmons are, you know, they are hatched in rivers, you know, in the northern countries. And, you know, rivers way inland, sometimes thousands of kilometers inland. And then just as very tiny newly hatched fish, they float with the water out into the ocean and live in the ocean for 6 years, something like that, depending on species. But, you know, still they live in the ocean for 6 years and grow, you know, become, you know, big, fantastic fish. And then suddenly an urge is there that drives the fish, and, you know, in thousands and millions of them, to flock back again, go back to this, and they could, each fish go back to the same river that it came from, and it swims up against the river, against the current, you know, even jumps up over small waterfalls and like that, you know, with great effort they go back to the place where they were hatched, and then they lay their eggs there and die. So how can they find their way back, you know, to that particular river? How do they know to the particular place where they were hatched? It's actually, it's quite mystical. Another example is of this Arctic tern. These are birds that live at the two extremities of the planet, on the North Pole and the South Pole. In the, you know, they have in the summer, They live up in the North Pole, or around the Arctic, you know, Greenland, Northern Scandinavia, Siberia, Alaska, places like that. And there they have their nests and their, you know, lay their eggs and so on. And then in autumn, all of them, they flock together, and then they fly all the way down to Antarctic, to the Southern Pole. Make incredible journey. They're of all migratory birds, they're the one who makes the longest journey. And then they spend the winter, which is the Antarctic summer, down there. And then, as again, when it starts becoming spring up here and autumn in the Antarctic, then they start flying back again to the north, where they go back and find the same place where they had the same nest, and again they're there. Except the young ones. So young ones stay at the in Antarctic for 2 years, flying counterclockwise around the Antarctic. For some reason, they fly there counterclockwise. Then after 2 years, they join the older birds and fly back and start their life up in the north. In the north, how can they find their way? Or maybe even a more amazing example. This was described in National Geographic in 2003, when National Geographic said this is one of nature's greatest mysteries. It's this butterfly here. It's called a monarch, and it's a butterfly that lives in the southern Canada, northern U.S. It's an American butterfly. So they spent the summer up there in, you know, northern U.S., southern Canada. But in the autumn, then all the butterflies, they fly all the way down to a place down in Mexico, very small area, actually, volcanic area. And they all fly down there to that place down in Mexico. And they die. All of them die. But before they die, they lay eggs. So a new generation of monarchs are born, and they live in there's a couple of generations of monarchs in Mexico. Then when spring comes, the generation that is living that time starts flying towards the north again, but doesn't make it all the way. They die on the way, and a new generation continues flying to the north. And there's, you know, a couple of generations, few generations live in the north, they die, and then a generation again flies all the way down to Mexico. How can they know? I mean, you know, what makes them, you know, do this journey again and again and again? I mean, it's not because of the brain, because butterflies, their brain is very tiny. And also they don't remember it, because they never made the flight. And also they didn't learn it from their parents, because they also never flew that way. They had to go back to the great-grandparents that were the last ones who flew. So nature is filled with mysteries like that. It's very strange behavior, or amazing behavior. What is, you know, how can it be explained? I mean, what is the nature of nature? Again, so, you know, I say this must be the answer. Bhagavad Gita is giving the best scientific answer. The Supreme Lord is situated in everyone's heart, or Arjuna, in his directing the wanderings of all living entities who are seated as on a machine made of the material energy. So, any if you had time, I had a short video clip from one boy remembering. Have you seen this Corsair pilot? Who has seen the story of the Corsair pilot? You've seen it. Have you seen it? Kind of. Anyone here? Can I show it? And then that's it. It's 4 minutes. It's quite striking.
Eleven. 11-year-old James Leininger looks and acts like most boys his age, but beneath his playful spirit is a very deep soul.
And I said, you know, I'm really glad you're my son. And I'm just really fun to have you as my son. And he says, well, he said, I know, that's why I picked you.
When we first met Bruce, Andrea, and James in 2005, his passion for World War II fighter planes was obvious.
I can beat the Japanese easy as pie.
The fascination began when he was a toddler. James seemed intimately familiar with the aircrafts.
He started doing these little drawings of airplanes shooting at other airplanes are being shot down. Bombing ships, you see men parachuting. Here's another one where planes are dropping bombs. This is a carrier.
The violent drawings were followed by extreme night terrors.
He would just be crying. He'd say, airplane crash on fire, and a little man can't get out. He laid on his back and kicked up at the ceiling, and he goes, Mama, the little man's going like this. And he laid on his back and kicked his feet up. The little man's going, ooh, 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 can't get out. And I said, well, who's the little man, baby? And he goes, me. I thought Bruce and I were just going to faint.
They questioned, what kind of plane?
Corsair.
Why did your airplane crash?
My plane was shot down.
Who shot your plane?
He looked at me like I was a village idiot. He said,
the Japanese.
Where did he take off from a boat?
Do you remember the name of your boat? He said, Natoma.
And his name?
He always said James. But his name is James.
Stunned by his son's words, Bruce tracked down veterans of the USS Natoma Bay.
I wanted to disprove it.
Columbus, Ohio native Leo Pyatt served on the ship.
He asked a few questions about, did I know some of the people? Oh, yeah, I remember those people. Yes, there was a Jim Houston, or rather large shell. Just hit him in the engine, and it pushed into flames and went down.
It was all real. James Houston, born and raised in the Midwest, was shot down over Chichijima, Japan.
He got very quiet.
The Leiningers were speechless again when James met Natoma Bay veterans and recognized them by name.
You're Bob Greenwald. I'm serious.
He's never met Bob Greenwald.
No, he'd never met him before.
They tracked down James Houston's sister, Anne.
And he goes, it's not Anne, it's Annie. She wasn't my oldest sister. I had an older sister than that. And I said, you did? Who was that? And he goes, Ruth. I mean Ruth.
Annie is what they called me when I was little. Knowing my name and my sister's name. Things that my brother did when he was a kid. It's too amazing to describe.
James recalled his favorite childhood possessions. And when we spoke to them via Skype, they shared one specific story involving James Houston's mother.
Annie had sent James the picture that her mother had painted of James Houston. And when James got it, he called Annie to thank her. And he said, where's the one Mom painted of you? And so she went and found it and sent a copy. And later on, she told us that no one in the world except her brother and sister knew that there was an identical picture of Annie when she was the same age.
Amazing stories like that caught the attention of Japanese filmmakers. Not long after our story aired, they flew James and his entire family to Chichijima, Japan, and the site of James Houston's plane crash.
Took a tour of the island, got up on a ridge overlooking the harbor. James said, this is where the planes flew when the day my plane was shot down.
Without any help, James knew exactly where the plane crashed. They held a memorial service and dropped flowers over the wreckage.
And James just got so emotional and just lost it. And it was just the most heart-wrenching thing.
But when it was over,
it was cathartic.
You know, it still gives me goosebumps to think that we actually got there and we were there and we were able to close the loop, especially for James, that it was something really important to him.
So they're still working on it. The University of Vienna and Charlottenville have this department where they're researching this stuff. Hare Krishna, thank you very much for.
Thank you.
So, so we can stop here. Srila Prabhupada ki. Jai.